it wasn't genuine. I was just so furious, but I couldn't show you, cause I know you, and I know what you can do, and I don't want a war with you, I won't afford it. You get sore even when you win. And you maim when you're on offense, but you kill when you're on defense, and you've got them all convinced that you're the means and the end. All the VIPs and PYTs and wannabes, afraid not being your friend. And I've always been too smart for that, but you know what, my heart was not. I took it like a kid, you see. The cool kids voted to get rid of me. I'm ashamed of what it did to me, what I let get done. It stole my fun, it stole my fun. Fetch the bolt cutters, I've been in here too long. Fetch the bolt cutters, I've been in here too long.
Fetch the Bolt Cutters by Fiona Alba. And that does it for our show. If you'd like to sign up for our Daily Digest, our quarantine report, you can text the word Democracy Now, one word, to 66866. That's Democracy Now, one word, to 66866. You can also sign up on our website at democracynow.org, where all of our video and audio podcasts are and our transcripts of every show. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. The majority of our amazing team is working from home. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamarie Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras, Maria Terracena. Special thanks to Julie Crosby and Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Health Authority reports the most deaths the state has seen in a single day so far. The Oregon Employment Department has fallen behind in processing claims. And Ohio holds its primaries today after a last-minute mid-March delay. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 28th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. As of Tuesday afternoon, there are 2,385 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Oregon. 99 people have died. The Oregon Health Authority reported 31 new cases on Tuesday, as well as 7 new deaths, the most the state has seen in a single day so far. In the state, 52,242 people have been tested, and 95% of tests have come back negative. The Oregon Employment Department announced that Oregonians impacted by the pandemic who did not previously qualify for unemployment compensation, such as self-employed gig workers, freelancers, and independent contractors, are now eligible to receive benefits. The U.S. case count passed 1 million today. Officials announced Tuesday afternoon that at least 1,010,000 people across every state, plus Washington, D.C., and 4 U.S. territories, have tested positive for the virus. At least 52,000 people with the virus have died. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 3 million people across 177 countries. As of this afternoon, at least 209,000 people have died. Facing record numbers of unemployed Oregonians, the Oregon Employment Department has fallen behind getting claims processed, and residents are wanting answers. Governor Kate Brown tweeted apologies on Sunday, emphasizing the crucial need for unemployment benefits at this time and her commitment to see that eligible Oregonians get their money as quickly as possible. Brown posted, quote, "I hear your frustration. I'm sorry for the delays." Oregon Speaker of the House Tina Kotek said in a Monday release that the Employment Department has handled an initial 230,000 claims over the last few weeks, but that a long queue of claims have not yet been processed. Kotek noted the delay that many are experiencing in getting their benefits and reminded them that initial claim must be processed before benefits may begin. For those out of work who have been waiting for several weeks, Kotek assured that once an initial claim is approved, benefits will be retroactive, and people will get the benefits they are owed, including the added $600 per week federal pandemic unemployment compensation. Over 300,000 Oregon claims have been filed to date as a result of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Overwhelmed by this surge, the Employment Department has reported they've added phone lines and increased staffing from 106 to 520 individuals. Even with beefed-up protocol, email responses have been taking longer than a week, and phone call wait times are averaging 100 minutes. Gift cards aimed at helping low-income families facing crisis during coronavirus were snapped up in a matter of minutes on Monday. In efforts to offset financial strains to low-income households amid COVID-19, the City of Portland provided gift cards of $250 available to eligible applicants on a first-come, first-served basis. Following the opening time Monday at 10 a.m., with over 1,000 applications received immediately, 742 were approved, depleting the funds within 17 minutes. The Visa cards issued were intended for urgent expenses, including rent, food, and vital bills. The applications were processed by 211 Info, a nonprofit that provides information and referral services via contracts with the city. Chief Executive Officer for 211 Info, Dan Herman, said nearly 300 people were waiting on the queue Monday before the lines were even open. Herman told Oregon Live, quote, "This just shows the raw need out there during the crisis," and noted after the application process closed, on-hold callers were rerouted to the nonprofit's general information line in hopes of securing alternate means of support. A deadly fire broke out this morning in Sweet Home, Oregon. KBOO's Al Khan has more.
Four people have lost their lives at a house fire in Sweet Home early this morning. According to the local fire district, a passerby saw the flames coming from a manufactured home on Terramuck Street and called 911 before attempting to alert the people inside. In a statement, Fire Chief Dave Berenger said firefighters arriving on the scene encountered smoke and flames coming from the center area of the home and fought the fire from the outside. When they were able to enter, they found the bodies of four people. Berenger said at this time, authorities are unable to determine the relationship between the victims, who have not yet been identified. The blaze took approximately 15 minutes to extinguish, and the home was a total loss. It is unknown whether or not the home was equipped with fire alarms. The cause of the fire is still under investigation. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
Despite an interrupted academic year and with uncertainties remaining facing coronavirus, many Oregon universities are preparing for in-person classes this fall. Announcements from the University of Portland, University of Oregon, and George Fox University were made on Monday, saying they plan on opening their doors and classrooms for fall term and that students are ready to resume. With student and staff safety imperative, the schools noted changes in protocol may be observed in efforts to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Universities will be focusing on lowering classroom density in accordance with social distancing guidelines, as well as making personal protective equipment available. Schools also hope that testing and tracking services become more easily accessible to students. The announcements also related how in-person classes will need to be coordinated with local, state, and national leaders, as well as following metrics put in place with other West Coast universities. Though optimism pervades, estimates are predicting a 15% decline in enrollment for fall, despite offices of admissions remaining open and still accepting applications for fall 2020. Oregon State University has yet to put out an announcement for its fall plans, but officials from the school say they are ready to get back to in-person classes, and the university is offering a virtual tour of campus available to first years and transfers. Ohio has its primaries today after a last-minute delay in March. Also, today is a special election in Maryland's 7th District to replace the late Representative Elijah Cummings. With more on those stories, here's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
I'm between Toledo and Cleveland in a rural area, so all our mail goes to Detroit. It takes, for me to mail a bill across town, it's about 7 days. So for us to put a ballot out a month out, it's a really tight turnaround.
Tricia Prunty, president of her local school board, says a six-week delay wasn't long enough for Ohio voters to request, receive, and postmark absentee ballots by yesterday ahead of today's primaries. Registered voters in Maryland's 7th District were automatically sent ballots for today's special election to replace the late Representative Elijah Cummings. It's a chance to practice an all-mail election with some in-person options at the district level before the June 2nd statewide primaries. That's how the president of Texas League of Women Voters, Grace Chemaine, sees their July state and local primaries as well.
This is a trial run for the November election, and we should try as hard as we can to prepare and be ready for it, but then use it as a lessons learned time to see what the best practices are for running an election during this crisis.
Texas still requires an excuse to vote absentee. Lawsuits are pending to determine if the coronavirus counts. Though Texas has the fourth youngest population in the country, poll workers are often over 65, a group at higher risk for COVID-19.
In Texas, we have something where even high schoolers can become trained as a poll worker and work during the election. So I just think it's a great opportunity to get more civic engagement in the younger people.
Youth voter turnout in Texas has grown in recent years, though it's historically been low there and nationwide. The question is whether the Biden-Trump divide will bring more people to the polls this year, says Washington Post columnist Karen Tumulty.
Now they've got the coronavirus. And, you know, this is a devastating blow, not only to health, but to the economy. And for a lot of people who are just starting out on their professional lives, who are burdened with a lot of student debt and are now seeing their employment opportunities potentially threatened, and they've got a lot to worry about.
Two-thirds of the 18 to 29-year-olds in a poll from the Harvard Institute of Politics disapprove of President Donald Trump's job performance. And in a general election matchup, former Vice President Joe Biden wins by over 20 points.
More surprising was that his margin over Trump was almost identical to the margin that Bernie Sanders would be enjoying if he were at the top of the ticket.
Pollsters also asked about Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi endorsed Biden, and New York's Board of Elections gave him the state's 274 delegates yesterday when they canceled their Democratic presidential primary. In other news, a landmark voting rights trial began by teleconference yesterday in Florida. The ruling could enfranchise hundreds of thousands of people with past felony convictions who have outstanding court fines and fees. In 2016, Trump won Florida by just 112,000 votes. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special encore presentation of our interview with Municipal Broadband PDX, which advocates for making the internet a public utility to expand accessibility. At 7, we'll hear Sojourner Truth Radio with Margaret Prescott, then at 8, The Melting Pot. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 52 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a high of 72. Today in history, in 1945, deposed dictator Benito Mussolini is executed by Italian partisans as he and his mistress attempted to flee the country. The quote of the day is from Indian political ethicist Mahatma Gandhi, who said, quote, "The true measure of any society can be found in how it treats its most vulnerable members." Tina Locklear of Robeson County, North Carolina, a Native woman, was murdered in 2018, and the case remains unsolved. Nadia Romlagan has more on that story with the Public News Service.
Jane Jacobs of New Hanover County says every day she wakes up feeling like it's December 20th, 2018, the day her 46-year-old sister, Katina Locklear, was murdered in neighboring Pembroke. She says she's had no closure in the case, which is ongoing. Research indicates Native women are more than three times more likely to be a victim of violent crimes. And in North Carolina, roughly 90 cases of missing or murdered Indigenous women and children, some cases dating back to the early 1990s, remain unsolved. Jacob says it's an epidemic.
Robeson County and even New Hanover County, Hope County, Bladen, Columbus County, there's huge Indian population. Us tribe people in Robeson County, we actually know hundreds of people that are missing and murdered.
Governor Roy Cooper has declared May 5th an official day of awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous women in the state. The Raleigh-based group Women Advance recently held an online rally featuring more than 20 speakers, including victims' families and elected officials, calling for legislation mission to create an accurate statewide database of victims. Erica Faircloth of Women Advance says since most North Carolina tribes are not recognized by the federal government, there are no accurate records of exactly how many Indigenous women have been murdered or have gone missing.
People, they just vanish all the time. It's been going on for years. No one can really pinpoint why. Anyone who investigates in the community, it's very dangerous for them to do so.
She also says misconceptions about what Native women look like contribute to the problem. When a crime is reported, victims are often misclassified as Black, white, or Hispanic. Jane Jacobs says she believes that when a victim is identified as Native, law enforcement tends to move slowly and prosecutions are rare.
Evidence has been missing and tests not done when they should be done and sitting on shelves for 2 years. It's like, even though we're standing up and we're raising our voice right now, we're not getting very far with getting the help and the resolution on what's happened to these people's loved ones.
She adds that Facebook groups like Shatter the Silence and The Missing of Robson County, NC, serve as gathering places for communities to share information and document ongoing cases. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Romlagan.
The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe's road checkpoints draw criticism. Tribes claim victory in a court decision over tribal COVID-19 aid, and May 5th is designated Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women's Awareness Day in North Carolina. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Bureau of Indian Affairs claims the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe has a checkpoint on a public highway to prevent non-tribal residents from accessing the reservation. Tribal leaders say the highway is not closed, but they're monitoring traffic due to COVID-19. Lee Strubinger reports.
The BIA says the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe cannot set up a checkpoint on US 212 without consulting the state. The agency says the tribe is not complying with federal law. Governor Kristi Noem says the tribe has not consulted with the state on the checkpoint.
We stand there ready to have conversations, but that is not something that the tribe has engaged in.
Earlier this month, Noem said the state was working closely with the tribe to allow essential travel and first responders into the reservation. Tribal officials say Highway 212 is not closed to anyone. They say commercial vehicles, farm equipment, and mail and medical travel is allowed. Harold Frazier is chairman of the tribe. He says the BIA claim that an outside entity like a state government owns something within the reservation is alarming. But Frazier says the tribe is pleased the BIA is concerned about closed roads for another reason.
So I'm really excited about that because we have a road here on a reservation that is maintained by the BIA, and that road has been closed for over a year. And the reason why it's closed for over a year, the culvert washed away. And, it's hindering our commerce, our members' commerce.
Frazier says he has had text and voice communications with the governor. Noem's deferment to local governments when responding to the COVID-19 outbreak helped shape the tribe's approach to the checkpoint. The Oglala Sioux Tribe has enacted similar checkpoints. I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Tribes are claiming victory in a federal court's decision Monday to temporarily halt the Trump administration from distributing Tribal CARES Act funds to Alaska Native corporations. More than a dozen tribes filed lawsuits against the U.S. Treasury Department to prevent ANCs from receiving shares of the $8 billion in tribal COVID-19 relief aid. Tribes worry ANCs could take half the funding and believe it should only go to tribal governments. The Ute Indian Tribe filed one of three lawsuits, which were consolidated by the court. The Ute Business Council applauded the decision and, in a statement, called on the Trump administration to distribute the funds to tribes. The ANCSA Regional Association and the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association in a statement said they were disappointed, but expressed optimism in the court system to obtain resources to assist Alaska Native people. Alaska's congressional delegation believes ANCs are misunderstood and that the CARES Act is intended to include them for funding. May 5th is designated Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women in North Carolina. Advocates and families want officials to take action, as Nadia Romlagan reports.
The Raleigh-based group Women Advance recently held an online rally featuring more than 20 speakers, including victims' families and elected officials, calling for legislation to create an accurate statewide database of victims. Erica Faircloth of Women Advance says since most North Carolina tribes are not recognized by the federal government, there are no accurate records of exactly how many Indigenous women have been murdered or have gone missing.
People, they just vanish. All the time. It's been going on for years. No one can really pinpoint why.
Facebook groups like Shatter the Silence and The Missing of Robson County, NC serve as gathering places for communities to share information and document ongoing cases. I'm Nadia Romlagan.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Supreme Court rejected the Trump administration's position on groundwater pollution. Changes in snowmelt threaten farmers in the West, and gloves, masks, and sanitizer bottles are being left in parks, on sidewalks, and in streets, then ending up in waterways. With all those stories and more, it's This Week in Water.
The latest threat to oceans? Face masks and gloves. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The U.S. Supreme Court announced a decision last week about water contamination, and the big winners were the environment and science.
In a 6-3 decision, the High Court ruled that polluters can't dump contaminants into groundwater, which then end up in protected waters like rivers or oceans.
Dumping pollutants directly into navigable waters is prohibited by the Clean Water Act, but it is less clear about pollution that begins before reaching those waters.
The case has national implications, even though it was focused on a Hawaii water treatment facility in Maui County.
Environmentalists claimed that the plant needed federal permits to inject wastewater into the ground because it migrates to the Pacific Ocean, where it pollutes beaches and causes algal blooms in the nearby reef.
Maui County and the Trump administration said the pollution's indirect path to the ocean put it beyond the scope of the Clean Water Act, but the court said that dumping into the ground can be the functional equivalent of a direct discharge into protected waters.
The ruling has big implications for the Environmental Protection Agency, which had said that pollution that moves through groundwater before reaching federal waters is not subject to the law.
The Supreme Court rejected the EPA's approach, saying it would open a loophole to evade the Clean Water Act.
The coronavirus pandemic is causing a shortage of carbon dioxide gas, which is used in food production, water treatment, and putting the fizz in some beers and popular drinks.
The situation is so serious that a coalition of food industry groups wrote to Vice President Mike Pence to ask for government intervention.
CO2 is used in the processing, packaging, and shipping of many foods and in the healthcare industry. And the brewing and beverage industries use the chemical for carbonization.
And many water treatment systems use carbon dioxide to lower the pH value to make water softer.
The shortage of CO2 is a result of ethanol plants shutting down. Ethanol is used as a gasoline additive, and producing it creates the carbon dioxide, which is then sold to industry.
But now, because driving has dropped during stay-at-home orders, many ethanol plants have idled, creating the shortage of CO2. Also, according to The Guardian, the Trump administration exempted some gasoline manufacturers from using the additive.
Farmers in Colorado and California who rely on snowmelt to help irrigate their crops will be among the world's hardest hit by climate change.
A new study set out to determine where irrigated agriculture has depended on snowmelt runoff in the past and the potential effect of a warming climate on farmers.
The authors conclude that a 4 degrees Celsius warming scenario could significantly reduce the amount of water from snowmelt.
In California's San Joaquin Basin, findings suggest that 14% of irrigation water must be met by new alternative sources. In the Colorado River Basin, the figure would be 9%.
The Colorado River supplies water for 90% of the nation's winter vegetable production, and even now is overallocated.
Other places where agriculture is at particular risk are located in southern Europe, western China, and central Asia.
The coronavirus is nearly everywhere in the world, and so are discarded masks and gloves used to protect us against it.
From Hong Kong and San Francisco to London and a Greek island, Gloves, masks, and sanitizer bottles are being dropped in parks, on sidewalks, and in streets. Much of it is plastic.
The used-up protective gear gets into sewers and washes into waterways in the sea, where fish, marine animals, and seabirds can ingest it.
Sustainable practices may take a back seat in times of crisis. Forbes reports that some in the plastics industry are taking advantage of the coronavirus to roll back environmental protections, claiming safety requires providing single-use plastic bags.
Many grocery stores have forbidden shoppers from bringing their own reusable bags, and some are handing out plastic ones instead.
However, others are addressing the mounting waste by making some gear reusable instead of single use. Ford is producing personal protective gowns from airbags that can be washed up to 50 times, and the University of Nebraska is testing ultraviolet light to decontaminate medical masks.
According to the Washington Post, officials in some communities are actively monitoring store parking lots and ticketing people who drop used masks and gloves on the ground. In Swampscott, Massachusetts, littering is punishable by a fine of up to $5,500. The department said that littering is making more work and worry for those who have to pick it up.
And finally, speaking of plastic pollution, a scuba diving group is turning trash into treasure by collecting water bottles that once choked our oceans and turning them into face masks to better protect against COVID-19.
CNN reports that the Professional Association of Diving Instructors, in partnership with Rasher, a company that sells eco-friendly activewear, are recycling ocean plastic to protect both the oceans and public health.
The double-layered masks come in 5 different designs based on marine life, such as whale sharks, manta rays, and great white sharks, and are machine washable.
They include 5 carbon-activated filters, which work for up to 8 hours each. The filters are not medical grade. The World Health Organization advises that equipment like N95 masks should be reserved for healthcare workers given global shortages.
Also, the masks are not a replacement for other protective measures like social distancing and hand washing.
The scuba organization says that based on current orders, the masks have helped remove nearly 1,300 pounds of ocean waste.
Our coverage of COVID-19 and water is made possible by you, the H2O Radio listener. Please sustain our reporting by donating at h2oradio.org, and thank you.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 28th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade and Al Kahn. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Host Paul Rowland speaks with longtime activist and media critic Norman Solomon. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings you the virtual debate between Nafisa Fai, Jeff Hinley, and Manuel Castaneda, 3 candidates for Washington County Commissioner District 1. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by listener support. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. I want to give a special shout-out to our interim co-station managers, Jenna Yokoyama and Celeste Carey. They do incredible work, and KBOO owes so much to them and their tireless efforts. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. Thank you.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
As the COVID-19 pandemic has pushed much of our daily lives online, the privilege of an internet connection has become a necessity. These days, an internet connection means you may be able to keep your job. It means school-aged children don't miss out on months of learning. But there are certain barriers to going totally online. Not everyone has the means to access it. Libraries and public spaces with internet accessibility are closed in order to align with social distancing requirements. This month, Portland Public Schools had overwhelming demand for Chromebooks for students to continue to study from home. Before the strain COVID-19 placed on internet usage, the idea of changing what internet connection looks like, how we pay for it, and who has access to it was changing too. Back in December, KBOO's Michelle Coppola interviewed members of Municipal Broadband PDX about their push to make internet service a public utility. Let's listen.
Welcome to In Depth, and our in-depth guests today are from Municipal Broadband PDX. On the phone, we have Michael Hanna, and in the studio, Russell Sr., both board members for Municipal Broadband PDX. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And do we have Michael on the phone? Hey, there you are, Michael. Hi. This is such a fascinating subject. The organization's goal here is to give consumers an alternative to the current slate of privately held internet providers by creating a community-managed network that's built to serve its people. That's essentially saying you want to make the internet like a public utility, like water and power and so forth. We really appreciate you joining us here on KBOO to talk about this today. Now, I just gave a brief description of the goal of Municipal Broadband PDX and its mission. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the organization started, why you decided to take on this goal of providing a public alternative to current internet providers?
So I've been involved with an effort to try to get telecommunications policy working in the interest of the users for the last over a decade with an organization called the Personal Telco Project, which is a local nonprofit. And we've been fighting for this for a while. Back in 2007, the city of Portland actually did a feasibility study to look at this and came back with a sort of a marginally positive result, but they decided not to go forward with it at the time. And subsequent to that, we had the potential of Google Fiber coming, which kind of put a campaign on the back burner. But it really got reignited 2 years ago when the incoming Trump administration FCC chairman said, oh, we're going to get rid of the net neutrality rules. And at that point, it smoked people out of the woodwork. All of a sudden, there was a groundswell interest in creating a public utility where, the user's rights could be validated in some way. Right now, basically, users don't have rights, and there's no institution really willing to stand up and give them rights.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about net neutrality later on, but first I want to back up a little bit. I know that probably most people listening could answer this question in some way, but what are some of the problems with privately held internet providers when it comes to accessibility?
Well, so first you have literally your choice is to either subscribe or not subscribe. There's no institution that's either willing or able to give you any more rights than that. So the big opportunity, and on top of that, they're just extracting wealth from people who use the internet here. On top of which, as a function of that, and their ability to control price, there are many, many people in our community that just can't afford it and forego what, today is an essential utility, an essential part of, it's no more a luxury than paved streets.
Right, exactly.
And just to add on to that surveys have found that about 28% of Black and Latinx and low-income households in Portland Metro lack broadband in the home.
Wow.
So there's a significant portion of our population that's being left behind. And as Russell said, this is just a fundamental part of life now, just like electricity or water. It should not be a luxury.
Right. I mean, you need the internet to get a job. You need the internet to hook up your electricity and water in lots of cases, to buy a home,
exactly.
To rent a place. It's not like it's an option anymore
to
do without.
To be a student, too. I mean,
to do your homework.
Everything is online now.
Right. Well, I can imagine that the privately held providers really want to protect their turf. And have they been actively involved in trying to quash this effort?
Uh, not allowed. We actually, they've been very quiet publicly. Mm. They've been not shy about spending money in other places where this has been on the ballot. For example, approximately 2 years ago, there was a ballot initiative in Colorado where they needed to, they actually have to have an election. In Colorado, they have to have an election just to consider doing this. They have to opt out of a state law. And they were outspent by the cable and telephone companies there $1 million to $15,000. And yet the citizens of, this is in Fort Collins, Colorado, the citizens there still voted 60-40 to go ahead. In fact, they're rolling out right now and signing up customers.
Wow. So since you talked about Colorado, let's open this up a little bit. This really isn't a very new idea. As you mentioned, it had been investigated in 2007 here in Portland.
Right.
And apparently it's a public utility in some other countries as well. Where has it been successful?
You know, I'm not so familiar with the examples in other countries. I know there are places, you know, Sweden has a much different telecommunications model than we do in the U.S. And I know, you know, East Asia, South Korea and so forth, they have a different model as well. In the U.S., we're sort of constrained by what the FCC lets us do.
Mm-hmm.
They basically set the rules on internet, and you know, they've basically been just handing the keys over to the companies that own the infrastructure.
Have they been in any way helpful? Are they interested in partnering with your efforts in any way?
Not so far.
No.
That we've
heard. Well, I'm just wondering.
Yes.
I mean, I'm just thinking from a public relations standpoint, they're always trying to make themselves look better and more community-minded. This would be a great way to do it.
Well, from an efficiency point of view, it's really silly to have more than one infrastructure in the streets. There ought to be a high-capacity infrastructure, and then everybody ought to be able to use it. It's called an open access model. They do that in different places. We used to do that for DSL here.
Mm-hmm.
You could, you know, the phone company owned the phone wires that went to your house, but if you were an ISP, you could essentially contract with a phone company and be able to sell your ISP services over the DSL. So the thing that really screws us here is that it's super expensive to put the infrastructure in the street. And then the rules around that are such that the owner of that infrastructure basically controls it completely. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to get a competitive environment that way. You know, you don't have choices, basically.
I think one key thing about the puzzle, too, is that currently the two largest providers, Comcast and CenturyLink, are running over their own networks. And so Comcast is running over the coaxial cable, you know, old cable TV wires that run into houses and businesses. And then CenturyLink is running over the twisted copper phone lines that have been there for a very long time. And so really what we're exploring in municipal broadband is running a whole new infrastructure along fiber optic cables, which, you know, most industrialized nations in the world are doing, running fiber optic to the home, because that really is the backbone of the internet, and that's really the only way to future-proof the network. You know, is something that has very high capacity, operates at near the speed of light, and would be an entirely new network. And so I think that's part of this whole thing too, is that this would be a brand new infrastructure. And with Comcast and CenturyLink, the two biggest providers, they have their own networks, and so there would be no reason for them to, collaborate with us on this, because it would be a threat to their existing networks.
Gotcha. So while we're on the subject of building infrastructure, what do you guys think about this national push for 5G, and how does that affect your network?
So 5G is what I like to call a gigantic hype storm right now.
Oh, okay.
So it means different things in different contexts. You'll see ads for things that are just kind of silly and not really connected to reality. And then they'll conflate that with something else. For example, T-Mobile was talking about their low-frequency things and how it'll go miles. And then they talk about super-fast things, which actually only goes about 200 feet or 200 meters maybe. Which would require stuff all over the place and does not go very far. So there are people talking about different things, and in the end, it's the phone company owning your access to something and being the sort of privileged middleman in that interaction. So your interests are not going to be well represented with 5G.
Gotcha. So let's talk a little bit about net neutrality, which we touched on a bit earlier, which sort of dovetails into this. Define the term right away.
So net neutrality is basically the idea that the carrier can't privilege one kind of traffic over another.
Somebody pays more, they get faster service, that
right.
sort of thing.
And, right. And, you know, you can there are analogies for this with, like, public streets, mm-hmm. right? You can drive or bike or whatever down a public street and turn off anywhere. You could stop, go to a public or private endpoint at the other end of your trip. And that's kind of what net neutrality is. There's an infrastructure. No one tells you where you can go and where you can shop. You can get from one place to another one, as well to one place as to another, pretty much. And so that's the basic idea. And because the carriers have this control, they can use, dollar bills go off in their eyeballs, and they say, we can make rules that favor us in some way, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just a blank slate of things that, little games they can play.
Well, of course, the previous administration felt strongly about net neutrality and how it was absolutely essential. How has that changed with the current administration? I mean, obviously a lot.
So the reality is that over the last couple of decades, the rules haven't changed that much. I mean, they've been continuously hostile towards the user and in favor of the owners of the infrastructure. There was a brief window in the end of the Obama administration where they finally found something that was an enforceable way of enforcing net neutrality. And we had that window where they said, hey, this is what we're going to do now. This is great. And everybody cheered. And the new administration came in and they said, no, we're going to yank that all back again. Mm-hmm. So, we get these little bones tossed to us as users occasionally, but the overriding thing is that the FCC really isn't our friend one way or the other, and we need to be solving this at a local level.
Okay. So we are talking with Michael Hanna and Russell Sr. They are board members from Municipal Broadband PDX about the goal of making internet service a public utility. So tell me, if this were to happen, what do you see as the impact on the community?
Certainly in the long term, we'll save lots of money. Right now, we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars on telecommunications just in Portland alone. I think the number I came up with was $300 million in revenue every year that goes to Comcast for their cable operations, which includes their television and their internet. We don't know exactly how much it would cost to build a network like this, but it's on the order of either $500 million or something like that. Maybe a little bit more, maybe a little less. That's partly what this, there's a feasibility study right now going on to help establish
here in Multnomah County.
On. Yes, exactly.
Okay,
right.
All right. And any status updates on that plan at all?
So it just launched in October. We're hoping to have results in the spring, you know, hope April to June sometime. And then we'll have a lot more information on which to judge.
And Michael, you're
and
on the phone,
other,
so I wanted to
yeah,
give
ahead.
You the opportunity.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention a few other benefits. I mean, I think as Russell mentioned, there's the concept of keeping money in the local economy, which can boost the economy through the multiplier effect and have jobs stay local, you know, because if in terms of building out a new fiber optic internet utility, there'd be a lot of jobs, local jobs in building that network, and then there would be jobs in operating that network. And then also local businesses can benefit, you know, new startups, local businesses can thrive. So there's obviously an economic aspect, but I think there's also an inclusion and access aspect that we're really hoping to be a model for other places around the country as well, where, you know, like I mentioned, there's a lot of people who are left behind currently. And so we really want to make sure that that inclusion is a core part of this. So homes with students have access to broadband, you know, subsidized broadband for low income or elderly households. And so, you know, really making sure that everyone gets a chance to participate in the economy and the technology advances going forward so that nobody is left behind.
Such an important issue. And if people want to get involved in helping you with this cause, best way to do that?
Just go to our website and sign up for our email newsletter. So we get periodic emails about updates of what's going on with the campaign. So that's the best way to plug in and also find us on Facebook and Twitter.
Wonderful. I tell you what, this sounds like an idea whose time has definitely been on the way, coming, and way overdue at this point. Once again, you can get more information at municipalbroadbandpdx.com.
.org.
Excuse me. I'm sorry about that. Yes, .org. Municipalbroadbandpdx.org. Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Russell, for being with us here tonight on In Depth on KBOO.
Thank you so much for having us.
Today, April 28th, marks the last day voters could register in Oregon ahead of the May 19th primary. There are important state and local races up and down the ballot. The COVID-19 outbreak has presented major challenges to primary voting around the country, as many states postpone their primaries to abide by social distancing guidelines. Oregon was one of the first adopters of mail-in voting and thus faces fewer challenges when it comes to keeping people's votes intact during COVID-19. The pandemic has prompted other states to consider mail-in voting in order to maintain accessibility for people in high-risk groups who may not be able to go to the polls. As such, we want to revisit our February interview with author and radio host Tom Hartman. KBOO's Michelle Coppola and Ken Jones spoke to Hartman to learn more about the challenges presented to voting, be it voter roll purges, disinformation campaigns, and redshift. Let's listen.
Our in-depth guest today, Tom Hartman, is a very familiar voice to regular listeners of community and commercial radio and podcasts, and an especially comforting voice to those who seek out progressive opinions and analysis. For his work hosting the internationally syndicated Tom Hartman Show, which has a cumulative audience of 7 million, Talkers Magazine named him the 10th most important talk show host in America in 2019 and the number one most important progressive host. You can hear his show weekday mornings on our fellow community radio station X-Ray here in Portland. In addition to his radio show, Tom has spent many years working with the International Salem Relief Organization, and along with his wife Louise, we hope you get better soon, founded a community for abused children in New Hampshire and a school for learning disabled and ADHD kids. And though I don't know how he finds the time, he's also a New York Times bestselling author with 26 books to his credit in 17 languages on 5 continents. Tom's newest book is titled The Hidden History of the War on Voting, Who Stole Your Vote, and How to Get It Back. And he's here now live in the KBOO studios to tell us more. Tom, welcome.
Thank you, Ken, and thank you, Michelle. It's really great being here with you.
Now, I wanted to start, there's so much to talk about, and we have a little extra time for this in-depth, which I'm happy about, but there was some breaking news yesterday, Tom. A federal judge in Georgia, Eleanor Ross, ruled against Georgia Governor Brian Kemp in a lawsuit brought by a person you know well, Greg Palast, investigative journalist.
He's an old friend.
And Kemp will now have to open up all files relating to the mass purge of over 500,000 voters from the rolls in Georgia and other states. Kemp was the Republican candidate for governor in 2018, running against Stacey Abrams. And in what seemed to be an extreme conflict of interest, he was also the Secretary of State overseeing the election. Can you talk about the significance of this ruling, Tom, especially in light of your book?
Yeah, Kemp was running a scam in Georgia that has become the go-to strategy for Republicans to win elections now in the United States. And basically it's use any excuse you can, although they've got some very specific techniques, to remove particularly people of color from the voting rolls. And then they combine this with a virus that was inserted into our law in 2002 in the Help America Vote Act. A new kind of ballot was invented with the Help America Vote Act, called a provisional ballot. If you show up to vote in Georgia or in any state for that matter, and the person at the voting counter, you know, says, "Well, I don't see your name in the book," you're given a provisional ballot. That you can't be turned away, so you have to be given a ballot. What is typically not told to people, and the vast majority of people don't know, is that provisional ballots are never counted unless an election is contested in court. And if you're given a provisional ballot, depending on the state, the laws vary from state to state, but typically you have 2 to 5 days to present yourself physically at the Secretary of State's office with your birth certificate, your passport, your proof of residence, proof that you were registered and perhaps removed inappropriately, all the kinds of ID that you would need to register to vote, plus, you know, proof of residence.
You would have to know that your provisional ballot wasn't counted, though.
You would have to know what provisional ballot even means.
Right.
And so if you can knock 500,000 people off the voting rolls, and, you know, let's say, you know, 100,000 of them show up and they're given provisional ballots, they think they voted. And, you know, this whole strategy really, I mean, it goes back a long way. There was a system called caging that the Republicans for almost 30 years were operating under a court order to prevent them from doing, sending postcards into poor neighborhoods that said, if you didn't send this back, you know, we're going to kick you off the list. But the Supreme Court legalized this last year because John Kasich wanted to kick 200,000 people off the voting rolls in Ohio because people hadn't returned cards. It went to the Supreme Court, and the 5-4, you know, right-wing majority said, oh, that's cool. But it really, in the modern era, as it were, really picked up in 2000 in Florida. We saw this thing called redshift, which is where the exit polls say that one candidate won, but the official results say another candidate won.
And in the book, you mentioned that these polls, especially overseas, are extremely accurate.
Yes.
So the redshift is quite
a shocking
discrepancy. Yes,
yeah.
A shocking discrepancy.
Yeah. In fact, I lived in Germany for a year. In Germany, when you vote, the elections are called that night, but it typically takes 2 to 3 days to count the vote because they're all paper ballots. You know, we just saw this with Boris Johnson in the UK. It took 3 days to count the vote, but they still pretty much called it the night of. It was pretty tight, so they didn't say for sure, but the exit polls are almost never more than a half point off, typically within 10%, you know, 0.1%, 0.1% off. And what we're seeing now is massive shifts between the exit polls. In fact, I'll give you a quick example, if I may.
Tom's picking up the book.
If I may borrow my own book here.
Yes.
Which you have marked. You have bookmarks all throughout.
Oh, I'm sorry if I screwed you up here. But this is you know, from the election of 2016. I mean, just looking at 2016, okay? And, gee, it's not where I thought it was.
Well,
oh, here it is. Hillary Clinton carried Florida, according to the exit polls. She won Florida by 2.5 points over Trump. According to the exit polls in North Carolina, she won by 5.9 points over Trump. According to the exit polls in Pennsylvania, she won by 5.6 percentage points over Trump. In Wisconsin, it was 5.1%. So in each case, people walked out of the voting area and walked outside and told the exit pollster, yeah, I voted for Hillary Clinton. And when the official results were tabulated, it showed that Donald Trump won. Why? Because they had been given provisional ballots, almost certainly. So this is where we see this results, and that's why I said this has become the go-to strategy. Just those four states would have given the election to Hillary Clinton.
I should mention some of the numbers. In Michigan, Trump won by a little over 10,000 votes. I think it was 10,700. In Wisconsin, he won by, what, about 22,000 votes, something
as
like
I
that,
recall,
Tom?
Yeah.
Yes, so kicking 100,000 people off the rolls or not counting 100,000 provisional votes really shifted the election.
And in Michigan, they kicked, it was just a little short of 200,000 off the voting rolls.
So that's why we have all this energy going into purging voter rolls right now,
that's
right
exactly
before the election,
right.
Correct?
That's exactly right, yeah. And where we saw this start was in the 2000 election down in Florida. The exit polls clearly showed that Al Gore won by tens of thousands of votes. And yet George Bush won by 526 votes, according to the official tally on the first ballot. Turns out that Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush, George's brother, had gotten a list of Texas felons from George and compared that list with Florida voters. Now, interesting thing about names. The name pool for African Americans is relatively small. Most were named after people who had essentially owned them mm-hmm. back in the day, and those were almost all Irish, Scotch, or English-speaking people. So there's a relatively small name pool for most African-Americans. Similarly for Hispanics, they all came out of one language, Spanish. But if you look generally at Caucasians, what you see is Czech and Russian and Slavic languages and Scandinavian languages, and I mean, just this huge spectrum. So if you're taking a felon list from Texas that's well over 50% Hispanic and black, and you're comparing that list loosely, they didn't compare middle initials or if they were different, that was no problem, and you're comparing those names with names of voters in Florida, what you're going to do is you're going to be and saying if anybody's name appears on both lists, obviously that's a person who is you know, traveling from Texas to Florida to vote and is a felon, and in Florida you can't vote if you're a felon. So we're going to throw them off the voting rolls, which is what Jeb Bush did. Somewhere between 30,000 and 90,000 African Americans were thrown off the voting rolls.
So since we're talking about historic scenarios here, your book is a history of the war on voting in the U.S., going all the way back to the writing of the Constitution.
Yes.
So this is nothing new that is happening here.
It's just new techniques.
Right, exactly. Due to time limitations, we're going to skip ahead just a little bit here. You write that Democrats controlled the House from 1933 to 1996, and that's mainly because, of course, their policies resonated with the American people. What started to turn that tide in 1996?
That's a good question. I think a chunk of it was that Bill Clinton in 92 did, you know, his campaign speech was called the New Covenant Speech, and you can Google it and read it. It reads like FDR. It's not how he governed. He took the trade deal that Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush had negotiated, NAFTA, pushed that through. It became part of his campaign. He consolidated media massively, so Clear Channel went from 100 stations to 1,000 stations. And,
yes,
and
I lived that.
Exactly.
You did.
Yeah, and put Rush Limbaugh on half of them.
Right.
He destroyed the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson's welfare programs. And I think by that point in time, people were very, very disillusioned. But there was also a couple of Supreme Court decisions. This is my previous book, The Hidden History of the War on, or the Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America, where in 1976 and 1978, the Supreme Court in the Buckley and First National Bank versus Bilotti decisions ruled that for, in the first case, billionaires, and in the second case, corporations, to give enough money to a politician that they basically owned that politician was no longer considered corruption or bribery. It was now considered free speech and protected by the First Amendment. The Republican Party jumped on this in 78 and said, okay, cool, we're open for business. Billionaires, corporations, come by us. The Democratic Party at that point in time was still largely funded by the organized labor. And about a third of Americans were members of unions in 1981 when Reagan came into office. By 96, you had union membership way, way down. It was down around 11 or 12%. Right now, it's a 6% in the private, you know, workforce.
Been active union busting. I mean,
right.
That's, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's how Reagan basically kicked off his presidency,
right,
going
right
after PATCO. And what the Republicans understood was, you know, they weren't, I mean, certainly they don't like unions, but they weren't interested in destroying unions just out of philosophy. They were trying to kill the funding for the Democratic Party. And they were successful, and which is why in 92, Bill Clinton had to sit down with Al Fromm and develop this thing called the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, and say, okay, we can't take, you know, there's not enough money in the unions to fund a campaign anymore, so we're going to pick clean industries. And if, you know, if you're old enough to remember the 90s, the Clinton was, particularly in the 96 election, was pitching this idea of blue-collar jobs are the jobs of the past, the new jobs are the white-collar jobs, you don't need a union for those jobs. And it was because the Democratic Party had started taking massive amounts of money from tech and from banking and from insurance and from pharma, from the so-called clean industries. And I think, again, that disillusioned people. They saw the Democratic Party no longer being the party of Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society and the New Deal, and instead turning basically into a kind of a Richard Nixon version of the Republican Party, a Republican Party light by today's standards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm one of those people who kind of believes that the upcoming election is going to be the one that determines whether we're able to save our democracy.
I think you're right.
I really feel strongly about that. And you have a subtitle on your book, Who Stole Your Vote and How to Get It Back? I'm always most concerned with what people can do to fight back.
Right.
And to make sure their vote counts. And maybe to, in my particular case, I come from a family who is a bunch of Trump supporters. And how do you talk to folks and make them see the disinformation, you know, especially when they're not reading regularly and not investigating? You know, what can we do?
With regard to disinformation, I think, you know, probably the best thing you can do is introduce them to progressive media, you know, whether it's websites or, you know, shows like yours, stations like KABU, things like that. With regard to getting your vote back, I think the main thing, I am shocked by the number of people, Democrats, participating Democrats, elected Democrats that I've talked to in the last couple of years, particularly when I started researching for this book, who have no idea about provisional ballots, who didn't know that these are just placebo ballots, who didn't know that these voting purges weren't just cleaning up the rolls from people who died or moved out of state, but actually were part of a systematic multi-decade program that the Republican Party has in place and is going to be continuing. It's at the core of what they're doing. So we need to educate people. We need to wake them up. And you know, it's not a problem in Oregon. frankly. It's not a problem in almost...
Preaching to the choir here.
Virtually all of the democratically controlled states, not a problem. You don't see redshift in these states. But in states where you've got a Republican Secretary of State, a Republican governor, and both houses controlled by Republicans, or even one house controlled by Republicans, if you've got a state that is on the verge of being purple, I mean, you know, Florida, for example, it went to Trump by 1 point. A year before that, it went to Obama by 1 point. And Texas is becoming like this, Arizona, New
Colorado.
Mexico, Colorado, yeah. Absolutely. In these states, we need to have people so sensitized to these issues that if somebody hands them a provisional ballot, they pull out a bullhorn and start absolutely raising hell and telling everybody they know, we've got to get the word out about this.
Well, Tom, the book is just incredibly relevant. And like Michelle said, you do go back to 1789, to the Constitution. Well, we're running out of time, so we can't even get to the way the Senate was originated.
Oh, yeah.
I had a friend
story
today saying, why do a few people in Kentucky deciding what's happening in the whole country? You know, it just doesn't seem fair. But thanks so much for coming into KABU today.
My pleasure, Ken and Michelle. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been talking with Tom Hartman, author of the new book, The Hidden History of the War on Voting, Who Stole Your Vote, and How to Get It Back. You can find out more about Tom, his new book, and all his work at tomhartman.com. This is Michelle Coppola and Ken Jones for KABU's News in Depth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.